We just saw a wonderful Hubble Space Telescope image of the Large Magellanic Cloud. That on reflection, there seems to be something beyond nature. There seems to be something transcendent, right? So something that is over and above nature. As we'll see, in the ancient world, there were different answers to this question, but they generally pointed towards something divine. What we want to do is we want to trace that story in the ancient world, and this will include looking at the Bible. We'll begin with the Bible. We'll look at the ancient Greeks, and then we'll go through the Middle Ages and the early modern period and bring it right up to date through the 19th and 20th centuries and on to the 21st century. And what I want to show you is that there is, throughout the history of Western thought, a general understanding or acceptance that there is some kind of design. Now, this recognition is just that, a recognition. As we'll see, there were different responses to this, and we want to kind of compare the different responses and think a little bit about what these responses might say about the reality that we find ourselves in. Okay, so let's begin with Romans chapter 1. It's a very interesting statement that the Apostle Paul makes in writing to the Romans. Now, it's important that we remember that Paul is writing to Gentiles, or at least to a predominantly Gentile audience. And so he's Jewish, he's steeped in the scriptures, what we now call the Old Testament, but he's engaging in the Greek language with Gentiles, with non-Jews who have come to Christ. And what he says is that even without the scriptures, someone should be able to determine that there is a God. What can be known about God, he writes, is plain to them because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived. And he uses a verb here, noeo, which is cognate with the Greek word or noun nous. And nous means mind. And we'll come back to this in a few moments. So this has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So Paul here is speaking in terms of creation, right? This is a creation theology. What we see around us is not mere nature, but it is a creation, we could say, with a capital C. So he goes on to say that they are without excuse, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their senseless minds were darkened. He has a more extended argument here about idolatry and the misunderstandings that idolatry represent. But the core idea here is that even without the scriptures, you should be able to come to some kind of knowledge of the divine, that there is something beyond the natural world or the cosmos, right? So that's the core idea there. He's not saying that in nature you're going to find a detailed doctrine about the resurrection, the atonement, those sorts of things. I'm not saying that. It's just a bare, basic understanding that there is something beyond nature or the cosmos. Now, when we go back and look at the foundation text about nature in the Bible, the book of Genesis, in particular the first couple chapters, the creation account, we find something very interesting. The account is given in a patterned way. So we see that the 6 days of creation are structured in two triads, days 1, 2, and 3, and then days 4, 5, and 6. And day 1 and day 4 match, day 2 and day 5 match, and day 3 and day 6 match, in this forming and filling pattern. Now, probably in part, it's structured in this way as a mnemonic. We have to remember that this is a largely oral culture, ancient Israel. And so there was a need to memorize because people didn't have copies of the Bible, personal copies of the Bible. But this text not only shows that God is creating using the Word, and we'll come back to that in a few moments, but also that there is a kind of teleology in the account. All right, what is teleology? Well, teleology is the idea that you can see in something, in a designed thing in nature, some evidence of purpose, that it was designed to do something. And so when we look at the Genesis account of creation, what we see is that the realm of light is created first, and then later, day four, the lamps are created. The sky is created, and then the creatures that live in the sky, the birds, are created. The sea is created, and then later the fish are created. The land is created, and later the land animals and ultimately humans are created. So what we see here is forethought. There is a purpose in nature, that nature is created with a purpose for inhabitants. So we have this pattern of habitats and inhabitants. Okay, when we look at Psalm 19, we see something else, and that is that the heavens declare the glory of God. So what is the psalmist saying here? The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. So one of the things that this psalm is telling us is that there is a kind of general revelation in nature. God reveals himself in a very general way through nature, through the heavens. Now, we don't see numerical patterns, formulae, those kind of rational things. Instead, it's a kind of ascetic understanding of the beauty of the world around us. And so on reflection, we think in terms of what is beyond the natural world or the cosmos. So this is a kind of revelation. If you read the rest of the 19th Psalm, what you see is that there are declarations about the Word of God, that it is perfect and pure, etc., etc. So in Psalm 19, we have two revelations of God, the revelation that we see in the created world and the revelation that we see in the written word. Now, clearly, the revelation in the written world is a lot more detailed. We have stories, we have accounts, we have names, and of course, we have lots and lots of teachings. The revelation in the created world is of a much more general nature. It suggests perhaps that there is a God. We might be able to extrapolate a little bit more about the nature of God, that God is a God of love because the world is beautiful, but there are some complexities because there are things that happen in the world, death and that sort of thing, that will lead to a more nuanced understanding of that God. So these are the two revelations, and this provides us with a foundation for what later, certainly Jewish and Christian thinkers came to describe as the two books. God revealed himself in two books, the book of nature and the book of scripture. So this is the nighttime sky. It's the bristlecone pine, Yosemite. So anyone, how many people have been to Yosemite? A few? Okay. It's a beautiful place. And so what we see is the Milky Way here behind that very aged bristlecone pine. In looking at the heavens in reflection, we think about what is beyond the heavens, that there is something greater than the heavens. The heavens reflect the glory of God. They reflect the greatness, the power of God. So this is a kind of ascetic argument, right? It's about the beauty of what we see. It's not a kind of mathematical argument. We'll come back to those kind of arguments a little bit later on. Now, in the book of Isaiah, we see lots of creation themes. And in this particular passage, Isaiah 45 and 18, we read the following. For thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it. He hath established it. He created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord and there is none else. So two core ideas here. One is that there is one God only, that the other gods don't have any real existence. But also that the earth was made to be inhabited. And this would refer to animals, but also, of course, to human beings. I have some Hebrew verbs there, and those verbs all come from Genesis 1 and 2. So he's using Isaiah is using creation language. It's actually a noun there too, tohu, but it's all from the Genesis account of creation. So now we come back to Romans chapter 1, and we have, I think, a slightly better idea of what Paul is getting at here, that we can perceive that there is a God from the things that he's made. So it's not a direct encounter with God. Instead, it's an encounter with the things that God has made. And he uses this word noeo, which is the verb form of the word for mind, right? So it's more of an intellectual process. So this is maybe slightly different from what we see in Psalm 19, which is more of an ascetic kind of argument, that you reflect on the beauty, you're overwhelmed by the beauty and the majesty of creation. We see, in fact, both of these arguments in the Bible, that in a kind of rational reflection, one could come to this conclusion, but one could also come to this conclusion after viewing, for example, a beautiful sunset. Okay, a couple passages from the book of Hebrews, where we see that there is an element called faith. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen, for by it the people of old received their commendation. By faith we understand that the world was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was made out of things which do not appear. So this idea of faith is not scientific. It's not rational. It's something different. It is more of an emotional kind of thing, a response to what we see around us, to certain kinds of evidence, not complete evidence, incomplete evidence, and then we, with faith, come to the conclusion that what we see around us is a capital C creation, and that there is a God. And then a few verses later, we read this: "And without faith, it is impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists." And the Greek there, hati esten, is just "he is." We must believe that he is. And some English translations use that. And that he rewards those who seek him. So, again, it's not a scientific argument, but it's something different. The faith that a believer has bridges the gaps in the evidence. The evidence is not complete. If the evidence for God's existence was complete, then it would be just a matter of doing mathematics. And the idea here is that God is asking for something different than that kind of calculation. Okay, so I want to just go back to this idea of God creating with the Word. I mentioned that very briefly when we talked about Genesis chapter 1. Now, if you think about this a little bit, what we see is God saying, "Let there be light." Right? This is what is called a fiat. Fiat is not just an Italian car, but it is the Latin word which means "let there be." Right? Let something be. And so God says, "Let there be light." But if you think about it, this involves forethought. God just doesn't randomly say, "Let there be light." He imagines what light looks like and then creates it. So what we see is the world is the result of the Word, which implies forethought and some kind of reason. Now, the two directions that we see here is that the Word, and the New Testament uses the word, the Greek word logos. The logos is kind of embedded in the created order, but it also then speaks out, right? We saw the language of speaking in Psalm 19, that the heavens declare the glory of God, the firmament showeth his handiwork, day unto day, etc., etc. We have the language of speaking. And that makes sense if you think in terms of what the creation account is saying, that the world is the result of the Word. It comes from God's spoken word. Now, this, it turns out, is actually a very important idea in the history of science. So that's my profession. I teach history of science. The idea that the world can actually be understood because it is actually the product of a mind is absolutely foundational to Western science as it emerges in the early modern period. Okay, so in terms of biblical teleology, this is somewhat anachronistic to use this term in this context, so you'll have to excuse the anachronism. Because I'm a historian, I get very uptight about anachronisms, so I'm kind of slapping myself on the wrist here. But again, teleology is the idea that there is some kind of purpose, right? So Psalm 19 speaks in terms of divine glory. So we could call that the x-axis. And the y-axis would be the idea that the world is designed for human habitability. So when we look at the world around us, we see that it reflects divine glory. That's what Psalm 19 is saying. We look at Isaiah 45 and also Genesis chapter 1. We see the idea that there is purpose in the created order, and one of those purposes is that the world is designed to be inhabited. Okay, now, in the New Testament, we have some moments when Jewish ideas or Hebrew ideas come into contact with Greek ideas. And we see this in Acts chapter 14 when Paul is speaking to the people of Lystra, and they mistake him for a god. And then a little bit later, he's facing stoning. So it was quite a day for him. But what he's doing is he's criticizing Greek idolatry, Greek polytheism. And he says to these men, don't worship me. Why are you doing these things? We are also men of like nature with you, and we bring you good news that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. In past generations, he allowed all the nations to walk in their own ways. Yet he did not leave himself without witness. For he did good by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with good, with food and gladness. So he's speaking language that the Greeks would understand. They understood that there were seasons, that there were fruitful crops and that sort of thing. And Paul is saying, this is actually the God that I worship, the one God. There aren't any other gods. So he's critiquing idolatry, but he's speaking common language to get them thinking about the one God. And something similar happens when he goes to the Areopagus or Mars Hill, as we just had read for us from Acts 17. He writes, the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives all mankind life and breath and everything. He is actually not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. So again, he's critiquing idolatry, but he's also participating in a debate that was ongoing in the Greek world. And that is the debate over whether or not gods could be represented by statues. Right? This was actually a debate that was going on at that time in Athens. So he knew, in other words, he knew his audience. Now, those two sections there that are in bold are actually quotations from Greek authors. So the first one is from the author Epimenides, who is a kind of semi-mythical person from the 7th or 8th century BC, but certainly there's a text that's associated with his name. And in this text, we see Minos speaking to Zeus, who is a kind of high god in the Greek pantheon. And what he's criticizing is the Cretan idea that Zeus was a mortal. And this author believes that Zeus was immortal. They fashioned a tomb for you, holy and high one. Cretans always liars, that's quoted in the book of Titus. Evil beasts, idle bellies. But you are not dead, you live and abide forever, for in you we live and move and have our being. So Paul clearly doesn't agree with the polytheism here, but what he's trying to say is that there is some vague recognition that there is a God. So Zeus is not the same as the God of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, but a high God. So there's a kind of a vague analogy there. And so Paul is trying to get to come around to the monotheistic God. The other quotation is from Aratus's Phenomena. It's all about what we would call meteorology, the constellations, those sorts of things. And Again, we see a reference to Zeus here, the idea that Zeus is everywhere, but also that we are all his offspring. And so Paul is quoting this text, which clearly doesn't teach the same thing as the Bible, but it uses the language of deity. Aratus was a Stoic. So what does that mean? It means that he was basically a pantheist. He believed that nature and God are the same thing, right? Clearly, if you read Paul's speech, as we just had read for us, you'll see that Paul didn't believe that. So what he's doing, again, is he's trying to get the Greeks to recognize that there's a kind of vague recognition in their thought of what we now call monotheism. And he quotes their own texts to that effect. In quoting Aratus, he's also getting involved in this debate about whether gods could be represented by statues, etc. The Stoics argued that gods couldn't be represented in that way. So Paul is very clever in the way he's using these sources, and he knew that there were Stoics there. The text says that there were Stoics and also Epicureans there. Okay, so let's just think a little bit about what some of these Greek thinkers taught. Anaxagoras, so we're going back to around the late 400s BC. He writes, "And what was to be, and what was and is not now, and what is now, and what will be, all these mind order." So this is the idea that if you look at nature, you come to the conclusion that there is a mind, a capital M mind, that who ordered that, and that would be associated with some kind of God. This is not the God of the Bible, but nevertheless some notion of God. And then Zeno of Citium, who is the founder of Stoicism, again, the Stoics generally were pantheists, although they did use the language of gods. He had this idea that there is this kind of logos, or universal reason, also called it God, that is the principle that organizes and governs the cosmos. So again, for someone like Paul, this is a kind of vague recognition that there's something behind it all, there's some kind of organizing principle, but clearly it's a long way from the personal God of the Bible. Some more familiar figures. Plato has this idea that the objects of geometrical knowledge are eternal. So he believes that there is an eternal realm where numbers exist, and that what we see in this world is a reflection of that. And this is something that early Christian thinkers saw as being very similar to what one would believe if one was a monotheist. Plato also used this argument, God always acts geometrically. So the idea that if you look at the world around us, the cosmos, the way the heavens move, you see some numerical patterns, and that is a reflection of the divine. Ae ha theos geometri. God always acts geometrically. Literally, God always geometrizes. Aristotle, Plato's student, argued that there is something called the divine that holds all nature together. It's not the God of the Bible. It's a very vague conception of God, but nevertheless a recognition that there is something behind it all. Now, this is a general trend in Greek thought, but there were some exceptions. So the Epicureans, including Lucretius, argued instead that everything was the result of chance and the random interaction of atoms. The Epicureans probably believed in the gods. They just didn't believe that the gods had a lot to do with the day-to-day running of the cosmos. But the Platonists and the Pythagoreans certainly did. And they had this idea, it's a very rational argument, that there is at the foundation of reality number. And this number is associated with the divine. And we see this in Nicomachus of Gerasa from around 100 AD. So that's right at the end of the closing of the New Testament canon. Galen, a very important medical thinker, in studying organisms, including the human body, in his book On the Usefulness of the Parts, a text that we teach when we're taking our students through ancient Greek medicine, says that there is design in living organisms. And this is the result of a powerful craftsman or a demiurgos. Not the God of the Bible, but there again is a vague analogy there. And then if we look at some indigenous religions, we see very similar ideas that there is a world. That world was caused. Where did the world come from? It came from the gods or God, as it says here. No rain, no mushrooms, no God, no world. So this is not a mathematical argument. It's just a kind of intuitive argument that would be common in this African culture. Okay, as we move into the Christian era, we see some similar themes. So Marcus Minucius Felix, in the early 3rd century AD, uses the analogy of the home. If you come into a home, you see it well ordered, you assume that it was designed, it was put together, it was planned, and he says the same thing of the world, which is like a home. It is our home. So that is a kind of design argument. A little bit later on, Augustine, he had all kinds of ideas. Many ideas that he had were not very biblical, but here you see him commenting on what comes to be called natural theology, that you can derive a kind of theology out of nature. It's very basic. The idea is basically that there is a God. But why did the eternal God decide to make heaven and earth at that particular time and not before? If the motive for this question is to make it appear that the world is eternal without beginning and therefore not the creation of God, then the questioners are far away from the truth and affected by the deadly madness of impiety. For leaving aside the utterances of the prophets, we have the evidence of the world itself in all its ordered change. So we see order and movement and in all the beauty. So there's the ascetic element again. It presents to our sight a world which bears a kind of silent testimony to the fact of its creation and proclaims that its maker could have been none other than God, the ineffably and invisibly great, the ineffably and invisibly beautiful. So that from around 400 AD. And then we begin to see this idea of the two books, which I alluded to earlier, emerging in the Middle Ages. God wrote two books, the book of Scripture, which we have here, and the book of nature, which we see around us. And they're both revelations. They're different kind of revelations. One is very general, and one, of course, is very specific in what it teaches. One of the corollaries of this idea is that if God wrote both these books, then there shouldn't be a conflict between them. There shouldn't be a conflict between the Scriptures and nature. If there is a conflict, then our interpretation of either nature or Scripture is at fault. Now, the Stoics had this idea of this world soul. Remember, they're pantheists. They don't believe in a personal God. Instead, they believe in a kind of generalized force that is animating the world. In the Middle Ages, this idea is kind of creeping around in the margins, but increasingly, the medieval thinkers began to speak about a machina mundi rather than an anima mundi, a world machine. And this happens around the time that the clock is invented. And so we begin to see the clockmaker argument or the clockmaker analogy, that the world seems like a clock. And in fact, the earliest clocks were models of the cosmos. As you can see from this clock in Prague, you can see on the face of the clock the sun and the moon. So the analogy was that the world is like a complicated machine. And in fact, in the Middle Ages, the most complicated machine available as an analogy was indeed the clock. So this is the beginning of the clockmaker argument. The world is like a machine. Machines are created, they're designed, so therefore the world must have been created. So it is a design argument. The medieval thinker Aquinas had developed in his life five proofs for the existence of God. The fifth one is the most famous, the proof from the governance of the world. So he argued that if you see order in the cosmos, if you see evidence of governance, that there is a governor, then this implies that there is a God who caused that order. So this is a design argument. It's also called the cosmological argument. In Islamic thought, we have a very similar idea. So Alistair McGrath, who's a Christian thinker, summarizes what is called the Kalam argument. Number one, everything which has a beginning must have a cause. Number two, the universe began to exist. Number three, therefore, the beginning of the existence of the universe must have been caused by something. And then number four, the only such cause can be God. So the causal chain ends with the divine. So that's very similar to Aquinas' argument. Okay, and again, we see the idea of the two books being developed in the Middle Ages, and this takes us into the early modern period. So in Protestant theology, you have this idea that there is a general revelation and a special revelation. So this is the natural world and the Bible. They're both penned, as it were, metaphorically, by God, and so you're going to find harmony between them. We see this in Dutch Calvinism, in the Belgic Confession from 1561. We know God in two ways. In the first place, through the creation, preservation, and government of the whole world, for this is like a beautiful book before our eyes in which all creatures, big and small, are like letters which show us the invisible things of God. And then we see an allusion to Romans 1, which we're familiar with. And the other way that we know God is through the scriptures. And again, those are the more detailed revelation. Francis Bacon, who helped found scientific methodology, argues that the intellectual can study both of these books, the book of God's word and the book of God's works, divinity or philosophy, right? Let men endeavor an endless progress or proficiency in both. One can do both. They both come from God. One will find harmony between them. We see similar ideas of the book of nature in Milton's Paradise Lost. To ask or search, I blame thee not, for heaven is as the book of God before thee set. And this is all based on this idea that God creates using the spoken word. And so, therefore, it's a form of writing. And so what we see in the world is a kind of book. Obviously, it's a metaphor, it's an analogy, and it's not exact, but it gives us some insight into what these people are thinking about. Another founder of modern science, Robert Boyle, believed in natural theology, that you can derive understanding of God from natural theology. And here in this engraving, which was put on one of his posthumous publications, we see an inscription showing an etching showing Robert Boyle himself, and then this text right here, ex rerum causa supremum noscura causum, to know the supreme cause from the causes of things. So you study causation, and this takes you back to the supreme cause, which for Boyle is God. And Boyle actually added a third book to the two books, and that is the Book of Conscience. And this is the book where you reflect on the first two books. And then we see in the early modern period all kinds of books being published about natural theology. John Ray, one of the founders of botany, the wisdom of God manifested in the works of creation. These are both theological books and science books at the same time. They provide a lot of detail on science. This is Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton also thought in a similar way. So most important book in the history of science, the Principia Mathematica, which laid the foundations for modern physics, astronomy, and, of course, the laws of motion and the inverse square law of gravitation. In this book, he presents a design argument. God therefore placed the planets at different distances from the sun so that according to their degrees of density, they may enjoy a greater or less proportion of the sun's heat. Today, we would call this a fine-tuning argument. We'll come to that in a few moments. Interesting enough, he took that reference to God out, but he more than compensated for it when he added the general scholium to the second edition of the Principia. I'll say something about that shortly. Around this time, he wrote this, Deus ex operibus cognoscitur, God is known from his works. So that's very similar to what we saw in Robert Boyle. We know God from his works, that is, his creative works. There's a kind of understanding that comes about the existence of God on a reflection about the intricacy of God's works. So the general scholium, which I've just mentioned, was added to the second edition of the Principia. It's only just over 1,000 words in the original Latin, but some colleagues and myself are editing an entire book just on this document, more than half of which is about theology and the theology of nature. So he says, this most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. And he also argues that the stars were set up in such a way so that they wouldn't fall together from their mutual gravity. So this is a kind of fine-tuning and design argument. And he argues at the end of the theological section of this addition to the Principia that we can discuss God from the appearances of things, and this is part of natural theology, natural philosophy, which is an earlier form of what we now call science. One of Newton's followers published the book The Astronomical Principles of Religion, Natural and Revealed. Natural, that's the book of nature. Revealed, that's the book of Scripture. And he presents a clockmaker argument that the world around us looks like a clock, and this implies that there is a clockmaker. Now, you may be familiar with this language right here from Joseph Addison. We're going to sing this hymn as we conclude. This text right here, published first in 1712, is a hymn that is based on that natural theology that I've just been speaking about from Newton, from William Whiston, and some of the other thinkers in Britain at that time. The spacious firmament on high, with all the blue ethereal sky and spangled heavens, a shining frame, their great original proclaim, the unwearied sun from day to day doth his creator's power display and publishes to every land the work of an almighty hand. So hopefully this will look familiar to you because it's very similar to what we see in Psalm 19, second stanza, and then the final one, forever singing as they shine, the hand that made us is divine, right? So that is what we call natural theology. The classic book on natural theology was written by this man, William Paley, 1802. Notice the full title, Natural Theology or Evidence of the Existence and Attributes of the Deity Collected from the Appearances of Nature. So what Paley does is he collects all of the natural theological arguments of his day, puts them together in a very well-written book, and he wants to make two arguments, that there are proofs for the existence of a designer God from the evidence of the cosmos and the natural world, and we also see some demonstrations of God's attributes, that he's a loving God, he has foresight, etc., etc. He employs a two-stage method, which involves observing nature, this is exactly what science does, and then a rational reflection on these observations. And at that stage, you reflect on the higher causes. So his argument basically is that if you're walking on a heath in the English countryside and you encounter a watch, you assume that it had a designer. And he says you should come to the same conclusion about the natural world. He says there cannot be design without a designer, contrivance without a contriver, order without choice, arrangement without anything capable of arranging, etc. So it is an inductive argument. This is the same way that science works. Philosophers of science call this inference to the best explanation. So what Paley is arguing is that the best explanation for these things is God. Of course, by this time, and even in the ancient world, as we already saw with the Epicureans, there were people who said this is not the best explanation. But certainly, for much of Western history, this was the dominant explanation. So we come to the modern era. Cosmic coincidences, cosmic necessity, or cosmic design. In the 20th century, we begin to see some arguments about the fitness of the environment for life. And so this book by Lawrence Henderson is one of the first books in the history of what we call the anthropic principle, that it looks like the world around us is designed for life, that it is specially and finely tuned not only for any life, but for human life as well as animal life. So, in a book on the history of the anthropic principle, we read about water. So one of the things that Henderson wanted to point out is that water is very special. And this book by Tipler and Barrow says the following in its section on water. Water is actually one of the strangest substances known to science. This may seem a rather odd thing to say about a substance as familiar, but it is surely true. Its specific heat, its surface tension, and most of its other physical properties have values anomalously higher or lower than those of any other known material. The fact that its solid phase is less dense than its liquid phase, ice, floats, is virtually a unique property. These aspects of the chemical and physical structure of water have been noted before, for instance, by the authors of the Bridgewater Treatises in the 1830s and by Henderson in 1913, who also pointed out that these strange properties make water a uniquely useful liquid and the basis for living things. Indeed, it is difficult to conceive of a form of life which can spontaneously evolve from non-self-replicating collections of atoms to the complexity of living cells, and yet is not based in an essential way on water. And so this book spends a lot of time talking about water. Some other thinkers from the 20th century, Sir James Hopwood Jeans, an English mathematician, physicist, and astronomer, said the universe begins to look more like a great thought than a great machine. And one of the things we see happening in the 20th century is a move away from mechanical metaphors like the clockwork metaphor back towards a notion of a mind behind it all. So this is Sir Fred Hoyle. Looks very, very English, does he not, with his tweed jacket. And he was an atheist. But he recognized that it looked like the world was designed. My common sense interpretation of the fact suggests that a super intellect had monkeyed with the physics as well as with the chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond a question. He never accepted the existence of a God, but he did. He was quite comfortable. Maybe I shouldn't say comfortable. He was happy to admit what for him was a bit of a challenge. Freeman Dyson, another scientist, said something very similar, that it looks like the world around us is designed. This seems compatible with the idea that there is a God. Another atheist, Richard Dawkins, takes the watchmaker metaphor and makes it into the blind watchmaker. So what we see him arguing for is that the watchmaker is actually blind, and that design in nature is not real or actual, but apparent. But it is interesting that there's still an acknowledgement that it looks like the world is designed. So he writes, all appearances to the contrary, the only watchmaker in nature is the blind forces of physics. And then in the same book, the essence of life is statistical improbability on a colossal scale. So the way to answer the argument that it looks like the world is designed is to say it's very unlikely that the world would have come about, but it has come about. And that is essentially his argument. Paul Davies, who is not doesn't seem to be a Christian, but is not an atheist either, apparently, writes about these cosmic coincidences. And he says that the evidence that there is something going on behind it all is very powerful. The impression of design, he says, is overwhelming. Science may explain all the processes whereby the universe evolves its own destiny, but that still leaves room for there to be a meaning behind existence. Martin Rees, in his book, Just Six Numbers, argues that there are six cosmological constants, numbers that if they were just a little bit off to several decimal places, life as we know it wouldn't exist, the universe as we know it wouldn't exist. This is a man who attends Anglican Church, but is actually himself an agnostic. Nevertheless, speaking about these cosmic coincidences. Another argument that emerged in the 1970s is directed panspermia. This is the idea that there is a universal genetic code. How do you explain that? How do you explain that? So Francis Crick and L.E. Orgel, Francis Crick, co-discoverer of the double helical structure of DNA, 1953, with James Watson, they won a Nobel Prize for that, argues that life was seeded on the earth by alien intelligences, right? So this is a kind of design argument. It's acknowledging that there looks like there's design, but it's not taking the theistic way out. It's taking a kind of science fiction way out. This only puts the problem back one other stage because you still have to come up with an argument for where the aliens come from. More recently, in 2013, some scholars published this paper, The Wow Signal of the Terrestrial Genetic Code. They argued that they did find evidence of design in the genetic code and that maybe this came from aliens. So again, this is acknowledging the same evidence that theists acknowledge, but coming to a different conclusion. So here's the book that I just quoted from, The Anthropic Cosmological Principle. This is the idea that it looks like the world around us is designed not just for life, but for human life. That the way the stars form and where the elements come from the stars, right down to the water on the earth and that sort of thing, make it look like the earth is designed for humans. Remember Isaiah 45:18. But there are two interpretations of the anthropic principle. So one is that if we weren't here, the world would be different. The fact that we're here, obviously our existence is consistent with the way that the world is. That would be a secular response. The religious response is that there is indeed something significant, religiously significant. So again, cosmic coincidence. There's lots of books on this. Those are Martin Rees's six numbers. If any of you want to know what they are, I've got a list of them up here. So the expansion of the universe, just right. This is called the Goldilocks effect. Everything seems to be just right. Number of spatial dimensions, possible spatial dimensions, number of time dimensions, where we are, that is the only place where life as we know it can exist. The relative strength of strong nuclear force, the relative strength of electromagnetism, the tiny space where we are, all these other possibilities, and life doesn't exist. The privileged planet. So this is written by people who are believers, unlike those previous examples, arguing that our planet is privileged, that it looks like it's designed for life and for us. And so we get this idea called fine-tuning, the fine-tuning argument, which leads to two different conclusions. So the fact that our world is fine-tuned, everyone agrees that it is. But there's two possible explanations. One is design. That's the argument that we see going back to the ancient world. The other is the multiverse, that if you have a large ensemble of universes, you're going to get one that where everything is just right. So it's a kind of cosmic lottery argument, right? So the design argument is obviously religious. The multiverse generally is secular, although there are religious people who believe that. The interesting thing about this argument is if the multiverse is disproved, in fact, it can't be proved, and you can't observe other universes by definition, then those people who use this for a secular argument, are they going to all agree that there must be a God? It seems an interesting way of approaching this because it looks like they're setting themselves up for a possible crisis. There is a kind of dialectic that goes on between the idea that design is undirected and the idea that design is directed. So Paley, responding to Charles Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, who has a kind of proto-evolutionary argument, and he comes up with the divine watchmaker. Darwin and later Dawkins in his argument for the blind watchmaker reacting against Paley, but then the intelligent design movement arises reacting against the idea of a blind watchmaker. So 20th anniversary of Darwin's black box, Michael Behe, his idea is that there is irreducible complexity in the cell and that the component parts don't work on their own, so therefore this must be evidence of design. This idea has been debated. Some people have challenged it, but this is what the idea is. Michael Denton, Nature's Destiny, How the Laws of Biology Reveal Purpose in the Universe is another example of this kind of thinking. Stephen Meyer's Signature in the Cell, the idea that the cell has information, right? This is consistent with this idea that God creates with the word. So we see something like a language in the human cell. The intelligent design theorists have a kind of taxonomy of different kinds of design. So apparent design would be Dawkins' idea, that the design is just apparent. Optimal design is ideal design, but it's actually not possible in the real world. Intelligent design is what he calls real design. So you see design, and this leads you to the idea that there's an intelligence. The intelligent design people don't say that it's this or that in their books generally. They just say that it's intelligence. In fact, some intelligent design theorists say that maybe it is aliens. It's just mere intelligence. But it is a form of the design argument. So finally, more recently, we see the argument that we're living in a computer simulation. And Nick Bostrom, a philosopher based at Oxford, published a paper in 2003 making this point. Are we living in a computer simulation? And so here we see Ray Kurzweil, a computer guru who is an advocate of this view. Neil deGrasse Tyson, a very well-known science popularizer, takes this view. And Elon Musk of Tesla car fame and SpaceX fame. So an article that was published just in September of this year outlines this idea that we see evidence that the world is designed. We know that there are computer simulations, and we extrapolate from that that a very advanced civilization would be able to develop a super high-res computer simulation right down to the individual atom. So Elon Musk, again, is one who takes this view. Ray Kurzweil, who says maybe we're in the science experiment of some junior high school student. I hope not. So three possibilities. Intelligent civilizations never get to the stage where they can make such simulations, and perhaps they wipe themselves out first, or they get to that point, but they don't create simulations, or they're overwhelmingly likely to do so, and we are overwhelmingly likely to be in a simulation. So the question then becomes, which of those options seems the most probable? And I just added a little note there, that the Earth alone has intelligent life is apparently not considered. So I'm presenting this as a kind of design argument. So what they say is that if you look at the world, we see numerical patterns. We see granularity, which you would expect in a digital environment. The universe appears to run on mathematical lines. This looks like a computer program, et cetera, et cetera. Now, as a historian of science, what I would say about this is that this is just the latest analogy that's used. The analogies that are used in history of science are the ones that are at hand. But we don't see arguments for computer simulations in the ancient world because computers didn't exist. We do see arguments that the world looks like a mind because people understood minds. We do see arguments that the world looks like a clock in the Middle Ages because by that time, clocks existed. So this is just the latest example of that kind of thing. Okay, I want to show a very short video clip, and then we will wind down. This is a video clip that presents some of the fine-tuning arguments that I referred to earlier. Okay, so that just outlines in a more illustrative way than I can present in slides the idea behind fine-tuning, that it actually is fine-tuning down to multiple decimal places. Okay, so let's conclude. Arguments for the existence of God from cosmology. People who study this point to at least four different kinds. Design argument, the idea that design in the argument points to God. The teleological argument, the idea that purpose in nature points to God. The cosmological argument, the universe must have a higher cause, who is God. And the eutaxiological argument, that is, when you see order, lawfulness, and comprehensibility in the cosmos, this points to God. So Paul Davies, who was quoted there, and I quoted him earlier, makes an interesting point about what he calls the algorithmic compressibility of the universe. What is that? That you can take the laws of nature and you can reduce them to an algorithm or a formula. So that is just astounding. Why is that the case? Now, he doesn't say whether it's God or not, but he suggests that there is something beyond it. So these are different kinds of design argument. Now, I'm arguing that there are two kinds of design argument. One is an ascetic version, another is a rational version. What we saw in the Greeks, what we saw in these fine-tuning arguments, that would be the rational version of the design argument. It tends to be mathematical, tends to be associated with science. The ascetic version is more like what we see in the Bible. The idea that you look at the beauty of a sunset and you reflect on that, and that leads you to God. These are not incompatible. It's just that they focus on different things. They point in the same direction. We've looked at some different analogies that are used for design. I suggested that the analogies that are used are the analogies that are at hand. Of course, analogies are limited. They only take us so far. But they all point in the same direction. There's something. There's some kind of purpose. There's some thing or being beyond what we see. And this is a consistent idea, even amongst people who are atheists who don't believe in God. There is an agreement that there is something that requires an explanation. So, to boil it down to its simplest elements, I'm going to argue that these are the two options that we see, theism or materialism. In theism, it's mind over matter. You have mind first, that is to say, God exists and then creates matter. In materialism, you have the idea that matter is there eternally, or it emerges, and then mind comes later through some kind of emergence, through evolution or something like that. So those are the two basic options that one has when one looks at the cosmos. And then there is the question of whether the cosmos, and it's a similar question, is the only thing that is. So Carl Sagan, who wrote a book and produced a documentary in 1980 called Cosmos, began this documentary with this statement: the cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. Does that language sound familiar to anyone? It should, because it's alluding to Revelation 1, verse 8. I am the Alpha and the Omega, says the Lord, who is and who was and who is to come, the Almighty. Right? So this is the mind, the creator. This is what how the Bible interprets the evidence that there is a creator or a mind behind it all. So those are essentially the two options. The cosmos is all that there is, or that the cosmos is a creation, a capital C creation, and therefore there's something beyond it, a God, and there is a purpose. The design argument only takes us so far. If we accept the design argument, as many believers do, it only gives us one piece of the puzzle. One has to take all kinds of different evidence and sort of triangulate them, and then they point to ultimately the God of the Bible. And this one involved looking at the Bible, fulfillment of prophecy, those sorts of things, and they would pinpoint the God of the Bible, whereas design arguments generally just show that there is a God, that there is something behind it. So I want to stress that the design argument does have that limitation, but it certainly, for a believer, is consistent, extremely consistent with the idea that there is a God. So, brief history of the design argument, some thoughts about why this argument has been so prominent in Western thought. And I'll just conclude by reading this passage from the book of Revelation one more time. I am the Alpha and the Omega, says the Lord God, who is and who was and who is to come, the Almighty.